Hello everyone, welcome to the Iron Dice. It's Dan Arrows here, bringing you a new episode on the war in Ukraine. This time I was lucky enough to be joined by someone who is actually in Ukraine and has seen the wreckage that the war has brought firsthand. His name is Dylan Burns. He is a journalist at Offbeat Research and also releases his footage from Ukraine on his YouTube channel. The two of us get into his own experiences on the ground, but also the question of whether Europe is going to crack this winter under the weight of the mounting energy crisis, our thoughts on NATO, and much, much more. So without any further ado, cue the intro.
We are determined that the vicious German cycle of war, phony peace, shall once and for all time come to an end.
This is London Court. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
Early this morning, the Soviet troops launched a general attack on Hungary.
Those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside.
Tonight I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen
the... Say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
Over a million people here celebrating a day that they never thought would come. A day in which Germany became one country again.
Launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
If the iron dice must roll, may God help us.
Okay, we're back with another interview. This time I'm talking to Dylan Burns. Dylan, thank you so much for coming on.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so you're in Ukraine right now. And at first, I want to talk a bit about your personal experiences being on the ground there. And afterwards, I want to switch to talking about the conflict more broadly. So first off, how did you end up making the decision to go to Ukraine all the way from the United States?
So I've been covering like politics and on Twitch and on YouTube for probably over two, almost 3 years now. And something I've always been deeply interested in is foreign affairs. I always found a deep interest in it ever since I was in middle and high school. I would use a lot of like open source intel websites to try to like follow the Syrian civil war day by day. I'm studying international relations in college. I've dropped out for a short period of time to do this, but that's what I'm primarily interested in. And for me, when the war started off, a lot of people came to my channel on Twitch and I saw like amazing like viewership, amazing numbers I've never seen before, because people knew that I was just somebody who talked a lot about foreign policy and was really interested in it. And I got a lot of money from it, like a decent amount of money. And it felt weird sitting there for like an hour to 2 to 3 hours, just watching tanks explode and talking about cities falling and like desperate last stands as people just dump money into my account. Not because I think I was harming or hurting anybody, but it felt like it was very low effort content for very like high amounts of reward. And I felt like the coverage I was doing was not good enough to substantiate the amount of money I was making. So I felt that if people, you know, thought my coverage was good enough to give me that amount of money, that maybe this is something I should invest in more since people are so interested in seeing it on my channel. And so what I decided to do is that I wanted to bring more attention to the war, definitely since I knew with time less and less people would be paying attention to it as the conflict, you know, expanded out from weeks to months to like now it's been about half of a year almost. And I wanted to go there and make sure that I could keep eyes on the war. And so I made the decision that I would be going originally to Warsaw, then it became Lublin, then it became Lviv. And like every week I would somehow get closer and closer to where the actual fighting is going on, because I wanted to get like my reporting to be more and more in depth. So I think a lot of it was motivated by me feeling like I've gotten a lot of money from covering the war from abroad. And so I should, if people trusted my coverage this month, I should invest it back into my coverage. I should make the coverage better since I have the opportunity. I want to make sure that I can keep people paying attention to the conflict and paying attention to the war. So I would say those are my two primary motivators.
It almost sounds like you're saying what your main motivator to go there was like a sense of guilt that you're like profiting off of the events while not really being on the ground, or did I get the wrong end of that?
Slightly. I think part of it was the idea that I'm making so much money while covering a war from like the comfort of my home and not even putting that much effort into it. Like, I can read a bunch of like documents and tell you about the war, but I was making more money covering it from the comfort of my home than a lot of on the ground reporters were making it. And my coverage wasn't even that good. And so if people were trusting me with this much money, or with, and I'm talking about a lot of money, I think it was about between $5,000 to $10,000 in a very short period of time, which is a lot of money for me. I wanted to take that money and reinvest it to make the coverage better. So I would feel that this is something that's worth the amount of people paying attention to this, or this is something that can, that is substantial coverage and not just me repeating what other people have already said before, or news headlines that I'm just going to, oh, look, hey, everybody, let me just bring this tweet that just showed up on my screen onto the live stream that you can all watch. I wanted to improve the coverage. If people are going to give me money because they like my coverage, the least I can do is improve the coverage so it isn't just like me copy pasting news articles.
Do you feel like there has been, if we look at like a war like Vietnam, for instance, do you feel there has been a decline in war reporting, or at least how much it is picked up in the mainstream media or resonates in the public? Like, when you see the effect that seeing, for instance, during the Vietnam War, you often saw news at the end of their segments just play a list of all the Americans that died in Vietnam that day. And that had a huge impact on American society. And with these kind of like forever wars that the U.S. is involved in, 9/11, there doesn't seem to be that kind of pressure building up in American society, except for like the progressive left. But there's no huge, it was no like gigantic anti-war movement that made a difference. There was a huge anti-war movement, but you know, the war still happened and dragged on until it was no longer feasible. Do you think there has been a decline in war reporting, or how much like people care about it in the United States?
I do think the amount people care about it in the United States has gone down. I think that the wars have gotten less bloody for America. Vietnam, we lost a lot more people than we lost in Afghanistan, a lot more people than we lost in Iraq. American tactics have changed, and the type of battles we are fighting have changed to a point where American casualties are minimized, while casualties on whatever side is at the other end of the United States geopolitical interests are maximized. And so from an American perspective, the idea of like all these coffins coming home is just not to the same extent that it used to be. We still have like dead soldiers coming home, but just not the same. It's not like Vietnam. It's not like World War II. It's not like World War I. It's not like Korea. And so I think that's part of the reason why people don't care as much, because we're not seeing the same amount of death and destruction. Honestly, I think, I'm trying to remember if this stat is true or not, but I think the biggest killer of veterans is like PTSD and suicide at the moment. It isn't actually war and conflict, which is a wild thing to think about. Not only is it wild because it just shows how low American deaths on the battlefield have gotten, no matter how many deployments we have around the globe, but it also just shows how tragic the lack of services a lot of troops are getting after the service, or the lack of care a lot of soldiers are getting after the service. So I think that's part of it. I also do think that it's not as exciting for after the 18th or 19th year to say another battle took place in the same country for the 19th or 20th year today. It's not going to get the same amount of viewership. It's not going to get the same amount of advertisers wanting to pump their ads in between segments, because not as many people are going to be watching. I've noticed even from myself the decline in the amount of people who are going to be interacting with videos or messages or new segments about Ukraine now than they would 100 or 150 days ago when the war was just kicking off. For a lot of people, it's old news. It's been going on for over 160 days now. And I think that also was partially motivating a lack of attention, is that we have a 24/7 news cycle today. And like very quickly, a war can become old news in the minds of many viewers, even if it's still very real for the people, you know, dealing with the war from a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I definitely want to get back to that, to the news cycle kind of pushing out the issue of Ukraine and it not getting as much attention now that we're 6 months in. But before I get to that, when you decided to go to Ukraine, how does that actually work? I know you went to the front, and maybe you can talk about that a little bit. Do you just like land somewhere in Ukraine and like look for someone in uniform and ask, hey, can you take me to the front? Or how does the process look like?
I just called my CIA handler, Dan, of course. It's complicated because I am walking into a field that I have no experience in. Now, I'm aware that everybody, when they first start out, they don't have any experience. They have to gain experience. And that's kind of how I looked at it. So what I did is I called a lot of people that I know that have been war journalists before. I called a lot of people that I know that have history in the military or history with being press in conflict zones. Somebody by the name of Patrick Hillsman was a huge help for me in that regard, who had experience in Syria. And I asked them, like, what type of stuff do I bring? Where do I get credentials? What about safety protocols, like routes in and out of certain areas? And I ran through everything I was supposed to before I even like hit the ground in Poland. I wanted to have everything mostly organized before I even hit the ground in Poland, which I was able to mostly accomplish. Once I was in Poland, that's when I was able to make more contacts with like fixers and people that could actually like set me up with interviews and stuff outside of the extent that I was originally going to do. Because originally I was just going to interview a bunch of refugees and then go home. But once I hit the ground in Poland and went to Lviv, I felt a lot more emotionally attached to the story. I felt a lot more personally invested. I found I was getting a lot more fulfillment than I was originally, than I originally thought I was going to get. And I found that I felt that I wanted to dedicate a lot more of my work to the story. And so then I worked to get a lot of more, like put a lot more personal money into it with fixers and safety protocols so I can get closer. And a lot of these opportunities are not like things where you have to go to like the Ministry of Defense and like say, hey, give me an interview. It's mostly like you just got to know people. And so that's why I believe in like sitting down, interacting with locals, talking to people who might get you in contact with other people, which that is how I eventually got to the front line, just by making sure I made good, positive relationships with people on the ground. Because if you're a freelance journalist, you don't have the connections that CNN have, MSNBC have. You're going to have to put in a lot of like legwork in order to get these interviews.
When the war started 6 months ago, it seemed to me that there was very little real war reporting going on the ground. The news around Ukraine got, I didn't even know how to say it, like kind of memeified. Like it was a lot of, you know, the soldiers on Snake Island telling fuck you to the Russian warship, or Zelensky, I need ammunition and not a ride and stuff. And there were no real like negative news about the conflict. And then 2 months ago, or 3 months or 2.5 months ago, there were like more mainstream media news pieces talking about the problems that Ukraine has, mm-hmm. Or be it financially or be it setbacks in the war. Has there been a change on how easy it is to get information from the front or from high-ranking generals or visiting field hospitals in Ukraine? Or how restrictive is it actually?
It's getting a lot easier to do reporting in Ukraine than it has been before. The fact that I'm even I'm accredited by the Ministry of Defense. I just had to prove to them that I'm like a legit journalist. This is something that helps you a lot at checkpoints, because if they're asking like, hey, why do you have a bunch of camera equipment? Because they're, you know, soldiers might be scared that you're a saboteur. Being able to show you them like, hey, this is a good reason for me to have all this camera equipment, that's going to make sense, and that's going to help you get into areas you previously couldn't have as a foreigner, because they might be scared that you're a saboteur or you're going to take pictures of troops and send it to the Russians. You're able to show that you're a reporter. And so all these processes have like slowly like fell into place. Recently, there was a decree. I don't even think it was recently. I think it was a month or two ago that the Ukrainian government said that if you are a journalist, you have a Ministry of Defense accreditation, you can stay in Ukraine for as long as you want. And it's almost like an encouragement of journalists to come to the country, stay as long as they want, because Ukraine wants to keep as much attention on the war as possible. So I would say that as the war's gone on and as all of the like systems have kind of fell into place to help accreditate journalists faster, to help go through all the backlogs of journalists who wanted accreditations, making it so that those journalists don't have to worry about visa requirements, stuff like that. It's gotten a lot easier for freelance and like establishment news journalists. I would also say that a lot of these aid organizations on the ground have never had to deal with as much attention as they're getting. The military has never had to deal with this much attention that they're getting at once. So I think that a lot of them have started to get like representatives who will go to the media, communicate with the media, set up interviews, set up embeds. And so as the war is going on, doing journalism in Ukraine is getting easier and easier, even if the reception we're getting is less and less because more people are not paying attention to the war as they were before. Because at the start, like, no one would have ever thought, A, that Ukraine was going to actually stand up to Russia and perform as well as it did, and B, that, you know, this conflict would still be going on this long and that there would be so much attention given to it. So at the beginning, I think basically everyone was just trying to scour for any information they could. And that's how you got like a lot of news articles about the most mundane things or a lot of unreliable news, because news publications were very eager to publish news because anything you put Ukraine in front of it, like the first month of the war, it would get a ton of attention. But they didn't have like the embeds or the local reporters to do the job properly. And so that led to a lot of bad reporting early on.
This is really more a question about the field of journalism rather than specific to Ukraine. But we should say that if you're a journalist and you want to report on this conflict, there is really no way to have like a complete bird's eye objective view of what is happening, simply by the nature of that you can't go. Like the scale is so big that you can't even really grasp all of it. And you can't just go over the front line and ask the other side, hey, what do you guys think? Because Russia doesn't allow independent journalists on their side. So do you feel like journalists who come to Ukraine, such as yourself, do you see yourself as contributing to the Ukrainian war effort in showing your viewers or other people what the Ukrainians want the world to see?
I will say that journalists, including me, in this conflict are some of the most ideologically minded journalists I've interacted with. I have yet to meet a journalist out here who isn't in some way like dedicated or kind of like Ukraine is a country that is the victim here and it deserves to be able to defend itself. And they're rooting for like Ukrainian democracy, which is very young and very vulnerable. And it's under threat, not only under threat by the Russian invasion, but under threat from corruption, under threat from internal forces as well, in collaboration with invaders who they might be able to see could leverage that collaboration for more power. And so a lot of the journalists I've interacted with here are extremely ideologically motivated. And the closer you get to the front line, the more I'm going to see it, because these are the people who are more willing to like risk themselves, where a lot of the journalists that there's a lot of people who just want to go to Lviv and just look in the camera and say live from Ukraine, and then they leave and go back to Poland and fly home, right? There's a lot of people who want to do that. And those are the people who I would say are less ideologically minded, but the people who are really staying here long term, they use the MOD permit to get embed, stuff like that, they're more ideologically minded. And I think that's not only due to the fact that this is such a almost clear-cut conflict when it comes to this is an invading force trying to annex territory, trying to do a regime change. It's extremely sympathetic. I think that's one reason why they're very pro-Ukraine and kind of look at it like I'm here to cover the war so more support can be given. But I think it's also due to the fact that the Ukrainians have kind of opened their arms to international press and said, come, 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 please, 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 while the Russians have done the exact opposite. And so it's almost inevitable that you're going to get a lot more sympathetic reporters in Ukraine who are kind of somewhat dedicated to like, I want to be here because I want to help the Ukrainian cause. If you'd have sit me down and asked me, I would say 100%. Part of the reason I'm here is because I want Ukraine to win. I don't believe in pretending that like I'm a completely unbiased journalist and I don't have my own opinions. And I do have an opinion. And I think from me coming here, it's only hardened that position that I think Ukraine is under threat from an expansionist state trying to project decades upon decades of Russian chauvinism onto Ukraine. And this is just the same kind of ghost of the Tsardom, which banned the Ukrainian language, which tried to deny Ukrainian identity. It's just the same thing. And so, yeah, I do think the reporters here are very pro-Ukraine, and I do think that they're more ideologically minded than a lot of other reporters I've ran into before this war.
Since you've been there, do you feel a change in attitude among Ukrainians or maybe even among your peers, Americans, of the attitude of how the war is going or maybe the way out of the conflict and such?
I would say that I have seen more of a change amongst Americans and foreigners than I have seen amongst Ukrainians. Ukrainians, the theme is generally the same than from when I first landed here, because I've been here for the majority of the war now. And the theme is still, hey, We need to win this war. This is not a question of if, this is a question of when. We need to protect our nation. We cannot doom those in occupied territory to the same fate of Bucha. It's like this idea is the general vibe I get from most Ukrainians. And all of the polling that I have seen seems to reflect this. The last polling I saw recently was like something like 84% of Ukrainians would be unwilling to secede any territory in negotiations, concede any. And that includes Crimea, which is much different than any position than the Russians would even try to enforce during negotiations. It's part of the reason why when I hear some people like call for negotiations right now, I understand where they're coming from. I just think it's like a hopeless call until one side has enough leverage to kind of intimidate the other into negotiations or make the other say, okay, I think I have to concede something here. So I would say that the Ukrainians, it's the same stance as ever. For the Americans, I think a lot of it is just time wearing down on them, where, you know, they were paying attention for the first week, the second week, maybe a third week, then months started going by. And eventually a lot of Americans have come to, I think, either two conclusions. And these are the Americans who have fallen off of support, which it has gone down, the amount of support from Americans. It's still like, and I'm saying from an American perspective because I am American. It used to be like, I think right when this war started, like over 70% of Americans were willing to support Ukrainians, even if it meant like economic damages to the United States. I think now it's 64. And it's kind of like stagnated at that level. And I think the people who fell off of it kind of see it as, hey, this has been going on for a while now. This is kind of like, maybe we need to start closing the door on this. And maybe there is some stuff we can concede to just, you know, end it because we don't want to keep having to spend all this money or send all these weapons to support Ukraine. My argument in response to that has always been, do you think that if we didn't send these weapons to Ukraine, that the money would be spent on food stamps? Do you think the money would be spent on healthcare? Do you think that's how the military-industrial complex in the United States works? But then the second response is this kind of, I don't want to call it concern trolling, because I do think it can be genuine at times, but this kind of position of like, we need to end the suffering for the Ukrainian people. We need to concede this, and the government needs to kind of, you know, back off this position because we need to end the suffering for Ukrainians, because that they're the real victims here. And I'll hear that sometimes from political commentators. But ultimately, I believe that when it comes to independent struggles, it is up to the people who are struggling for independence to decide when they've suffered too much for the cause of independence or they've suffered too much for the sovereignty of their own nation. And so it's weird to argue from that perspective when you're saying, hey, we need to help these poor Ukrainians by ending the conflict now in negotiations and possibly conceding to the Russian government, when those same people you're making that statement for would turn to you and say no, at least the vast majority of them would. So that seems to be the two biggest pushbacks I've seen from American audiences. But the majority of Americans are still incredibly supportive of Ukraine.
You see this sometimes among some left figures, and I don't want to pretend this is bigger than it is, because I think this is absolutely on the margins, but absolutely, this call for that the West is prolonging the conflict by sending weapons to Ukraine. And I get where that idea comes from. I think Jeremy Corbyn said something to that degree recently. But again, like he doesn't really play a role in UK politics anymore, in national politics, at least. It's not like I don't get where that come from, but like I'm a very realpolitik kind of guy coming from Germany, because that just means like Russia is going to win, or that just gives Russia an easier time to win. And then that's the reality that you have to accept when you say we should stop sending weapons to Ukraine. And I don't think that is necessarily better. You know, they can make their own choice. Doesn't mean that those deliveries can't be conditioned on, let's say, you know, you have to, hypothetically speaking, like at this point, send an envoy to a neutral country to talk to like a Russian envoy to just like keep a channel open for negotiation and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But to build a little bit on that, and this is going to be a bit of a long question because I want to paint a picture for you. And then at the end,
can I just quickly say one thing? Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that if you wanted the Ukrainians to do well in negotiations, they're going to need a large sum of weapons. Part of the reasons why one of the original war goals from the Russians was demilitarization was because they didn't want to, in the future, if they had a problem with Ukraine being too sovereign in the future or too, you know, independent from Russian interests, that they could quickly move in and crush them and they wouldn't have to face this type of trouble anymore. And so if they don't have a lot of weapons, say HIMARS systems or longer range missiles or Western provided weapons that they could use out in the field with force, then in negotiations, the Russians are just going to think, you have less leverage. You have less ability to fight me. You have less ability to struggle. It would not be as difficult for me to just continue fighting you because you don't have as much weapons in front of you. And the West has said they're going to stop supplying you with weapons. So I could just hold out. And so it's important for the Ukrainians to have the leverage to look the Russians in the face and say, look, we can drag this out if you want to. We can send more of your boys homes in coffins if you want to continue this terrible war. We're going to get more weapons, which is going to allow us to continue this war if necessary. And that gives them more leverage so they can get more out of negotiations. And that's important. The majority of weapons in human history have never been fired and have mostly been used as political tools, either to intimidate a civilian population against uprising or to intimidate foreign adversaries in negotiations.
Just a quick follow-up on that. We don't have to get too deep into that. But what I think you're saying is that even if you want less Ukrainians to suffer and you want a quick peace, there is a moral case that you have to, a practical and a moral case that you should keep arming Ukrainians. Do you extend that position just hypothetically to Iraq when the United States invaded them and threatened their sovereignty, or do you make a distinction there? Because Iraq obviously wasn't a democracy, but it was, you know, a functional country, even though it was a brutal dictatorship.
I would extend this to basically any country that is fighting off a foreign invader. I do think there can be like distinct like differences. For example, I think like in Yugoslavia, the difference would be there that there was active. Now, this word is used to kind of water it down, but ethnic cleansing taking place. There were people being placed in camps. And so there's other factors that can get involved in the situation that could maybe justify foreign intervention. But in the vast majority of cases, foreign nations should not be invading foreign nations. The United States should not have invaded Iraq. The weapons of mass destruction did not really end up being as nuclearly guided as was first assumed. And yeah, I would think that would make sense for other people in the region to possibly have armed Iraq in response to an American invasion. I will say that Saddam Hussein, unlike the government in Ukraine, carried out a genocide against the Kurdish population of his country, which was absolutely brutal. I will say that Saddam Hussein, unlike the current government in Ukraine, is also a dictator. And Zelensky, as much as many people might not like him, does have to live in a society where he can be voted out of office. Petro Poroshenko had to face that reality when Zelensky beat him in an election. And it was a really important moment in Ukrainian democracy because there was no evidence of interference. There was no evidence of vote rigging. There was monitors who watched the situation and saw that the votes that were being tallied up were the same votes at exit polls and entrance polls. And that was a big moment in Ukrainian democracy. And that's what's under threat. So I would say that there are moral distinctions between like a government like Saddam Hussein's and a government like the government in Ukraine. But I don't think the United States should have invaded Iraq. And I don't think many people could have really been too upset if other nations in the regions decided to arm Saddam Hussein, because they wouldn't want the same fate to befall them if America decided they were going to invade another nation in the region. But there is a moral distinction between democracies and dictatorships, genocidal regimes and non-genocidal regimes. Now, I will say, and I want to preempt this, some people will say that Ukraine engaged in a genocide in the Donbass for 8 years. That's not true. That's a lie. The UN General Secretary has said that's not true. The 14,000 number that people sometimes bring up is just the total amount of people who have died. That's just, total like, in the Donbass. Yeah.
Nobody actually like believes that. Like outside of like the Russian propaganda outlets, that there is like a genocide going on in the Donbass or whatever, or that Russia is acting defensively. And I don't think anyone who listens to the podcast believes that. At least I don't hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that like the only situation where I could have seen that would have justified an American invasion of Iraq would have been during the genocide of the Kurds. That would have been the one time where I could have actually been like, okay, this makes sense because we're stopping a horrific like atrocity that is going against the Kurdish people. We could step in there and do it right now. But that's not what happened. There was Operation Provide Comfort, but there was no intervention to actually topple Saddam Hussein to stop that genocide. So by the time the invasion of Iraq rolled around, the moral question of invading and not invading, I think, had already been answered.
Yeah. And there's also a difference between invading to stop a genocide or something that happened like in Yugoslavia, where you have a UN mandate most of the time, or just going into the country and just like smashing it to pieces removing the leadership and then having like companies plunder the place, basically. But getting back to Ukraine and the shifting attitudes of Ukrainians and Westerners. When the war broke out in February, we basically saw the entire Western world unite behind supporting Ukraine, rightfully so, I might add. Even though I'm like often critical of, you know, Western governments or NATO, Ukraine is clearly being the one who's aggressed upon here and who's fighting off a war of conquest by the Russians. They received weapons, financial and humanitarian aid. I think it's great that countries like Poland got around to taking in refugees if they're white. And Russia has been hit with severe sanctions by the West, at least. But now, 6 months in, it appears to me, and I'm curious if you agree with that, it appears to me that we start to see some serious cracks in the Western bulwark behind supporting Ukraine. And I just want to give our listeners a few examples. NATO country Turkey, for instance, has increased trade with Russia since the invasion and is now carving out its spot as the warehouse between Russia and the EU, where the stuff that Russia can't sell to the EU because of sanctions, they sell to Turkey, and the stuff that the Europeans want to buy from Russia can because of sanctions, they buy from Turkey. In France and Germany, the conversation of how much do we support Ukraine seems to have been completely pushed out of the news cycle by concerns over our own problems. For Germany, that's obviously gas, which we not only need for heating, but large swaths of our industry needs as an energy source that can't really be supplemented with any kind of energy. And France in particular is sometimes left out of the conversation, but they play a vital point in kind of, let's say, diplomatic angle that Russia wants to achieve, like, because they obviously want Europe to crack and to be forced to weaken these sanctions or be forced to make deals with Russia or whatever. And for France, like, they have like more than half their nuclear power plants not producing right now, partially because they're under maintenance, but also because the rivers are just getting too hot right now and they can't cool the plants anymore. And there was a piece in Bloomberg by Javier Plas that I want to read a part of you real quick, titled "Paris Faces an Even Colder, Darker Winter Than Berlin." And it says, quote, "For December, baseload French power is trading above 1,000 euros, almost double German prices, while peak load power, typically in the evenings when families gather for dinner and the heating is on, is changing hands at more than 2,000 euros. In practice, that means traders expect French power demand may be so high relative to supply that so-called hourly prices will bump against the 4,000 euro limit set by the exchange many times in December. The market, aware of what's coming, is trying to kill consumption ahead of time in an effort to avert blackouts." France has also broken a negative record for itself. This year, they had 102 days where they needed to buy electricity from overseas, while between 2014 and 2016, that number was zero. And as this domestic pressure is increasing among the West, you know, it's not just Europe. The U.S. is facing its own constitutional crisis that keeps it occupied. Is there a sense, now we're getting back to my question for you, do you feel like there is a sense among Ukrainians that the biggest support that they got is already behind them and that the time window where Western support could really make the difference and help them equal the odds, that time window is increasingly closing?
I think that the biggest weakness Ukraine has moving forward is a lack of Western resolve. That the biggest thing that could undermine Ukraine's war efforts isn't a lack of will to fight or a lack of soldiers or like a lack of political will from Zelensky's government, but basically either a lack of pressure on Moscow from the West or a lack of weapon supplies to Ukraine that they need to be able to, you know, fire at the Russian invasion. And I do not have an easy answer for this question, but what I will say is I am not very concerned about the United States, because U.S. polling on this issue has largely stagnated around 62 to 64% when it comes to not support for Ukraine, but support for Ukraine, even if it means an increase in energy prices and an increase in food prices, which I think is really good polling out of the United States.
If I can interject just real quick with the polling, I'm specifically talking about like not attitudes on the ground, but more like assessments that these governments make, whether like it's not worth it to pump more money into that.
The United States just approved another $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. I think we're going to continue to see military aid from the United States. Now, the United States has been the biggest supplier. The United States will, I think, continue to be the biggest supplier. The United States is not also as reliant on Russian energy resources as the rest of the world is. Now, increased energy prices around the world will affect the United States, but it's not going to affect the United States as drastically. The gas prices that a lot of Americans are complaining about are much higher in Europe at the moment for very obvious reasons. This is, I think, in part, the United States has been saved here a little bit by the fact that they have so much gas being domestically produced in places like Texas, for example. Now, Europe is where I am the most concerned. I'm concerned that the governments are going to think that these gas prices, which are extremely troublesome, are going to affect the economy, not only when it comes to, you know, the factories that are going to be having to pull back production, because this isn't one talked about that much, but factories are going to have to pull back production because
that's huge, yeah,
gas to actually supply it, which could mean shrinkage in people getting laid off. It could mean to these companies are not producing as much, so their output is much lower. It means their GDP shrinking. It looks like we're going to have some GDP shrinkage across the board throughout much of Europe. And if you're a German who just lost their job at the factory, then having to go home and then pay more for your gas prices, obviously this is a big issue. And this is something that I think a lot of governments are concerned is going to lead for fledgling support for their administrations, which then means they could be voted out. And that is concerning to me. But I don't know if I think the resolve will necessarily crack, because I think of who's going to replace these parties if they do lose the midterms. And in Germany, it's not going to be, what is it called? Die Linke? I forget what it's called.
Die Linke, yeah. Or the AfD, is the far right.
Or I don't even think it's going to be necessarily the AfD, if I'm completely accurate about.
No, that's completely. I don't want to say impossible, but it's very. It would probably impossible.
It'd probably be either like Merkel's party or some other party who are all also generally supportive of Ukraine. I think the only reason that support would drop in places like Germany is if they're just primarily concerned about holding on to power for their own party. Not that the idea that some other party is going to come in and they're anti-Ukraine, they don't want to support Ukraine, but that the effect on the domestic economy is going to make it so they're going to lose support because people think they're not running the economy well or they're not dealing with the energy crisis well, and then they lose power. And so what I'm concerned about, honestly, is these parties thinking very short-term about their own political power and not long-term about what's the best for their country, what's best for Europe long-term and long-term stability or like fundamental values of freedom, democracy, and not, you know, greasing the gears of the German, French, Belgian, whoever economy with blood of Ukraine, which is what this money flow into Moscow would mean. It would mean the blood of Ukrainians is greasing the gears of many European economies, because caving on sanctions means that the pressure on Moscow would be lifting. They would see it as a sign of weakness, and then they would just use that to push deeper into Ukraine. They would use it to as a kind of like a sign of we can keep going and we're not going to get backlash. And once they see that pressure is lifting, they're going to feel like they can go harder now, because now they can go harder and they can be less fearful of backlash because Europe's already cracked. And so I am genuinely scared about that. I think that is the biggest weakness Europe faces. Do I think they're going to crack? I have no clue to tell. I have no idea the answer to that question. What I can say is I think this winter is probably going to be – we're going to get an answer this winter on whether Europe's going to crack or not. What do you think?
I disagree with you a little bit. I'm more pessimistic towards support for Ukraine. And again, I'm not talking about polling among the public, because this remains relatively – high, although a plurality of Germans do support Ukraine ceding territory for peace, even though, as you said, that's not really there are no negotiations going on where that could even be a possibility for them. But I think my assessment is a little bit different of how the German. Let's just talk about the German government, because this is obviously the linchpin of where Russia hopes Europe will crack. Because if the Germans hop off and say, you know, we want to support Ukraine, but there's just nothing more we can do at this point, and we just have to think about it. We have to think about our own people here. Then then the deal is done for them. You know, then France is going to follow, and Italy we'll talk about in a second. The current government, which is the coalition of the Social Democrats, the Liberals, and the Greens, they have been relatively supportive of Ukraine. But my assessment of basically like all German governments post-World War II is that they are mostly acting out of what they believe to be in their own self-interest, as you said. And in the beginning of the war, there was a lot of moral pressure on Germany, on the German government, to do more, to quit buying Russian gas. And nobody's even suggesting that at this point, that Germany should stop buying Russian gas. That is something that is completely out of, some people might demand that, but that's just never going to happen. And I think no politician across the parties, no major politician across the parties pretends that that is a possibility. Let's say this government cracks and that's really unpopular and they get thrown out in 2 years. At the moment, Merkel's party, we also have politicians from the Christian Democrats who say, we want to support Ukraine, but we have to think about our own people. You know, we should definitely look into if we want to turn on Nord Stream 2, if Nord Stream 1 doesn't deliver that much gas. The view that I get of Europe's resolve is much darker, partially because this is not just about this winter. And I think you're right that we are going to get an answer this winter, but it's about the winter of the next year and the year after, because Germany's economy has been built for a long time on cheap Russian gas. And if the German economy slides into a recession, that's bad news for the entire Eurozone. But let's say, hypothetically speaking, winter comes and it's probably going to be the worst October to November. Something that is really dominating the German news right now is the fear of social unrest, especially in the East, that people are going to go take to the streets over gas prices. And we'll see increased radicalization. We even had our foreign minister, who's usually Annalena Baerbock, who's usually very confrontational towards Russia and China, say that when they were negotiating with the Canadians to release the turbine for Nord Stream 1, which is a breach of sanctions, they said, we want to support Ukraine, but if we don't get this turbine, we're going to have riots in the streets by October. Do you think that when that moment comes, and let's say, okay, November is here, Russia says, we have to do maintenance on Nord Stream 1 again. We can't let any gas through, but we can use Nord Stream 2 if you want to. And Germany cracks under that pressure. Do you think that Germany is like committing a grave moral sin there and putting its own self-interest over the interest of Ukrainians?
I think that it's not even necessarily in their own long-term self-interest. I think short-term, obviously, you solve the short-term issue of gas prices to a certain degree. You can maybe solve the short-term issue of possible discontent amongst the German population. But this is not – if we let this continue, as in we let Russia continue to brutalize Ukrainians and brutalize Ukraine, and we don't put a red line here, this issue is just going to pop up again, but it's going to be down the road at another location. Let's say Belarusians have another protest against another fraudulent election, and then the Russian army steps in and starts mowing down thousands of Belarusian protesters. Are we going to have the same question then as well about whether or not we're willing to like make this moral stance on this issue? Let's say we have another amount of training exercises along, this time it's Transnistria. In Transnistria, we have training exercises along the border of Moldova, and we're in the same situation where the Russians are talking about, no, this is just a training exercise. Don't worry, chief. It's all Gucci. And then we find out that it isn't all Gucci. Moldova's not a part of NATO. Moldova has Russian soldiers occupying a strip of land, about 1,500 soldiers, that could be made a beachhead of could be used as a tool of an invasion. And they could make the same talking points about NATO expansionism and the same thing all over again. What about Georgia if something pops off there again? I know this idea of like the secession of South Ossetia and that becoming possibly Russian territory. This is a big question. What if that becomes a moral issue again? I think what we're going to be doing here is just kicking the can down the road, where the Germans would then just have to answer the same question 5 years from now again, or 10 years from now again. Putin dying or leaving office isn't going to be like the death of this like ideological position that the Russians hold, that they can like dominate much of the Slavic world. They can dominate Ukraine. They can dominate Belarus. They can dominate Moldova, or possibly Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or a lot of these states that left the Soviet Union and ran to NATO afterwards because they knew that one day Russia would come back. The same issue is going to be there if Medvedev takes power or whoever takes power after Putin, as long as they're of that same ideological basis. So I don't even think it's in the interest of the Germans, unless they just want to have another energy crisis 5 years from now or 10 years from now. This, you're just solving the issue in the short term. So I do think it's wrong because, A, you're throwing Ukraine under the bus, but I also don't even think it's necessarily in Germany's long-term economic or strategic interests.
When you say this issue will come up again and it's going to be a problem for Germany or other European countries, what do you think about Germany or all of Europe basically being able to totally accompany with the fact that, you know, Turkey is in constant conflict with its neighbors or threatening its neighbor Greece, or, you know, the inhumanities of our other allies? Like, it comes up when Saudi Arabia executes like 80 people a day, but, you know, it's a blip in the news cycle and we are fully absorbed into, you know, we just rely on these connections, blah, blah, blah. And then there's another news story and then we forget about it. Do you think that like the humanity that Russia could, you know, unleash on Transnistria or in Georgia, do you think that could become normalized like that in a similar way?
Do you mean like you're basically commenting on like Western hypocrisy on Saudi Arabia and our like?
No, it's not. It's not hypocrisy because these situations aren't equivalent. But Germany as a country seems to be fully able to accept morally questionable behavior, be it the actions of Saudi Arabia or be it, you know, refugees drowning in the Mediterranean. You know, they're willing to go quite a bit to preserve their standard of living. And why would they not be able to go further in accepting that, you know, whatever Russia is potentially going to do to Georgia or Moldova, because we need their gas?
I mean, they could say we're not going to have a red line here, but if the German government would also need to accept possibly that next they would have to make the same moral designation upon Moldova. They would have to make the same moral designation if something about this, let's say they negotiate a short-term peace, if the Russians do this again in 2 years, this time with a properly managed invasion, not completely taking their commanders and their military by surprise, that's more well-supported and possibly no longer a special military operation, but just a full declared war from the Russian Federation, meaning they could pull upon conscripts and the laws upon recruitment are going to be a lot more loose. Or, of course, the brutalization of Belarusian protesters when eventually Lukashenko starts to crack again, which I think is either I think that's inevitable. I think the man is probably one of the weakest out of Putin's allies when it comes to political control of their home country. Or if there's some other moral crisis that the Russians get involved in. I mean, they can accept like personal self-interest over the interests of the rest in Europe, but also they got to also accept that this stuff causes economic instability. You can be as pro-Russia as you want. It's going to cause economic instability as your European neighbors are not going to be as accepting of the Russians taking over Moldova. Or if the Russians make an agreement with the Ukrainians and they violate it and they invade again 2 years from now, they lied about this invasion, they could simply lie about what they accept in negotiations. It's going to still cause economic instability as trade with Ukraine goes down, as Russia gets sanctioned from the United States or the rest of Europe. All you're just going to be saying is, I want to be a little bit above everybody else economically for the short period of time we go through this crisis, but then you're going to be perpetuating the crises down the road. Because you're going to run into this again if you don't stop them here.
I agree.
So just means longer term crises down the road. But of course, you're going to be one step ahead of the rest of the Europeans because you're caving to the Russians. But that still means more crises for you down the road.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, it's not just the moral dimension that I think of, because I don't think governments necessarily think in that way. But you see even how much tension this has created between Western Europe and Eastern Europe, you know, countries like Poland and countries like France who have condemned the French or the Germans or whatever over not supporting Ukraine enough. So this is not just a question of energy or, you know, economic opportunity, but the EU is a project that Germany shares with others, and the stability of that project relies on a closed front on security issues and economic issues.
I do want to say, like, I'm an American, so I'll never get this idea really of like this European identity, right? That has been scrubbed from my ancestors a long time ago, right? But from what I know, in Germany, there seems to be this bigger kind of like push amongst young people, particularly, to kind of have more of a kind of like a transcontinental European type identity, where you don't identify much as I am German or I am French first, more as I'm a European, I'm a person of the continent, I have the ability to without a passport, pass over from Germany to France to Italy to wherever I want to go and work there and live there if I so please, and yada yada, and all this. And I see this identity forming a lot of the younger people in my audience, particularly who are from Europe. And if you want to accept that identity, you got to accept what comes with it, which also means like being protective of you, of the people who are part of that, like, kind of group you're trying to make, the European Union, or the people who want to be part of the European Union, like the Ukrainians. And so it's weird for me on one hand to have people be so like dedicated to this European project, but once it gets any external pressure, being so quick to abandon it once it's put under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the reaction would be different if there was a similar pressure on an EU member like Lithuania?
I think Lithuania, one of the biggest issues is going to be is that there is an established red line when it comes to NATO membership.
Yes.
And so that's what divides Lithuania from countries like, well, until recently, Sweden, Finland, Moldova, Ukraine, Georgia. You get the idea. And so this is kind of, I guess, like the question is for a lot of Europeans is, are you willing to leave out the Ukrainians? Are you willing to leave out the Moldovans? Are you willing to leave out all of these people who want to be part of this project, who have very clearly multiple elections and through multiple governments shown clear interest in being part of the European project? And by all standards, you would call these people, at least if you're if you're not of a certain type of Austrian man, European, right? They're on the continent. They have a deep and integrated history. They have a lot of integration when it comes to the economy. There's many people from like Polish and Hungarian families which live across the border, and have people talk about this all the time when it comes to Russians and Ukrainians on how there's a lot of cultural ties between the border. But when I'm near certain areas of Western Ukraine, you hear a lot of Polish. You hear a lot of Hungarian in certain neighborhoods, and that's because there's a lot of crossover there. Are you willing to basically like just cut them out? Are you willing to abandon them? For me, and I'm not even part of the European project, I'm going to say no. And I don't know if other people are willing to sacrifice as much as needed to be sacrifices in the short term, though, to make that commitment through the winter. That's the question. Are you willing to abandon Ukrainians from the European project and from representative democracy, and possibly make that same commitment to nations like Moldova in the future, because the Russians don't seem to have any intention of stopping with Ukraine?
Yeah, I agree. Like, the question at the end of the day is just, you know, at what point does the idealism and the stated goal of the European project run into, you know, fuck you, got mine. You know, we don't care about anyone who's outside these established red lines. But, and I have to say this with apologies to our American listeners, I want to keep the focus on Europe for another Boo! Question. Because we are at the forefront of this, and there are like some developments going on, and this might explain a bit of my pessimism when it comes to European support for Ukraine. When we look at Europe's third biggest economy, which is Italy, their government has collapsed, as Italian governments tend to do. And one reason for that, this wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back, but one reason for that was tensions within Mario Draghi's coalition over support for Ukraine. And there's going to be a new election in September. And what it looks like from right now, what is going to replace the kind of technocratic liberal Draghi government is a coalition of Berlusconi's Forza Italia, Matteo Salvini's Lega, and Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia, which would be a far-right, post-fascist, anti-EU, anti-Western government. Among Western Europe, it's probably the most NATO-skeptical country. And this is one I want to get into with you a bit. When I look at these circles that you and I kind of move in online, mm-hmm. when it comes to NATO, the discussion seems to be kind of dominated by, there is like a small group of people who somehow got into their heads that Russia is fighting like an anti-imperialist war against NATO aggression, like something mm-hmm. completely unhinged. And then there's another side that sees this and says, well, no, actually, you know, NATO is actually like pretty cool and almost going like a strictly anti-defensive, anti-fascist alliance. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
So I've always been skeptical of NATO, mostly because I just didn't really understand the purpose of it post collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia's not the superpower that it used to be. I think now that, I mean, if anything, I think it's slightly been proven by their failed invasion of Ukraine, which hasn't resulted in the quick defeat that many people thought of that would come from the second most powerful military in the world. Definitely if you compare it to a lot of more recent modern invasions. And so I think for me, I kind of looked at it as in, well, I want more democracy. I want more alliance systems based on values. I want alliance systems that don't include nations like Turkey when they have the illiberalism kind of like grabbing at its core. Illiberalism when it comes to the suppression of the press or what the Turkish government's doing to the Kurds or what the Turkish government is doing with its support of the Azerbaijan invasion of Armenia. Or, well, I could, you know what? I think I could spend the whole podcast talking about the problems with the Turkish government.
Oh,
and I have
yeah.
problems with that. Oh, yeah. We could talk we about Greece. That. Yeah. We should do a whole episode of just angry. See how many like Turkish flag emotes we can get in like replies to our tweets moving forward. So I've always had those problems with NATO. I also do have problems with like some of NATO's past conduct. But this invasion has, I think, shown the need of an alliance structure in Europe still. And NATO is what we have at the moment. We have an alliance structure, and this is what we've got. And this alliance structure is what's currently protecting Poland. It's what's currently protecting Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, nations who do not, by themselves, have enough to defend themselves from, again, the second most powerful military in the world. It is what Finland is about to use as a cover to protect themselves from possible Russian invasions. And I think that NATO itself might have a lot of flaws, but there is still a need in Europe, whether it's NATO and you want to reform it in some way or not, Europe is still in need of an alliance structure to keep the nations protecting each other. Because divided, you are weak. United, you are strong. Platitude, rah, rah, right? Europe is stronger when facing an aggressive force like Russia, united than divided. It is part of that NATO kind of centralization when it comes to its military structure that it was able to provide so much support to Ukraine, period. A lot of NATO countries have been negotiating together when it comes to shipping them a lot of their old Soviet reserves when it comes to artillery, since the Ukrainian artillery is a lot of its old Soviet era. They've been working together when it comes to shipping them new NATO weapons and NATO munitions and the logistics that are needed to, you know, to carry this out. And so I think that whether or not you have a problem with NATO, your problem cannot be, I have a problem with the alliance structures in Europe, because we need an alliance structure in Europe. And this is what we have now. And so my question to somebody who's like, I have a problem with NATO, it's like, okay, A, what changes do you want to make to NATO? Or B, what would you replace NATO with? Because getting rid of NATO certainly means the destruction of nations like Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which the Russians clearly want to take. They just don't have the ability to right now because of these alliance structures protecting them.
I can answer that question because I'm not like too fond of NATO, but I'm kind of in your camp. Like, the invasion of Ukraine has shown the need for something like NATO, absolutely. When it comes to Europe, in a vacuum, I don't want Germany or France or any countries that are close by to us to be part of NATO. I want us to have an own defense structure. And partially that exists because the article that comes with EU membership on self-defense is actually more in text, more binding than Article 5 of the NATO agreement. But obviously, we or Europe really lacks the will to actually have something like that, because the deal is this, and this is not a con. You know, people like sometimes point out that, you know, oh, you know, NATO, they pretend to be this defensive alliance, but it's actually there to like serve American interests, and America is like the first among equals in NATO. Everyone knows this. You know, every country that comes into NATO is aware of this. The deal for Europe is, okay, we'll become part of NATO, we'll become part of this defense structure, and the US gets the benefits for them that comes with that, and that can be power projection for the Middle East and Africa from like the Rammstein relay station, for instance, in Germany. But on the other side, everyone in Europe can rely on the United States if there is a wolf knocking at the door, as we can see right now. You know, the support that Ukraine gets from the United States is much larger than what it gets from Europe. And that's kind of just, you know, that's the deal that we accepted. In terms of like getting rid of NATO, I asked Danny Bessner this of American Prestige Pod when he was on the podcast, if this is going to like, if this is going to be like a revival of NATO, because, you know, NATO was considered by, let's like Macron is like a brain dead organization. It doesn't really have a purpose. I think there's going to be probably going to be a short term revival. What I would like to see is that Europe does not rely on a foreign power for its defense, especially not one that is as erratic as the United States is. You know, we remember the Trump years, you know, and the commitment that someone like Trump had to defending NATO countries in the Baltic. Yeah, none of us forgot this. But I don't see how it can happen right now. It is possible.
Sorry, I need to bring this up. Do you remember when Trump got the Yugoslav civil war mixed up with the Baltics? And then he went to the Baltics and he was speaking to, like, I think it was like the president of Estonia or Latvia or something. He was like, your civil war got really sucked, guys. I'm happy you're all doing good. And they're just so fucking confused. Yeah. God, the Trump years, man.
Really makes me miss him. Like, but anyway, like when you look at what like EU countries spend on defense, it should be more than enough. I think it's like 250 billion annually, which is third after US and China and more than Russia. And we just get nothing for it. You know, ideally, I would like to have a strictly EU defense structure that is an equally secure red line as NATO membership is.
The United States, do you think that European power should have an alliance structure with the United States, even if it's a separate one? Like, do you think that it would be useful for Ukraine to be an ally of the United States or Germany or Italy or all these other countries?
I don't think there is anything wrong with having, like, a mutual defense pact of the EU, also if the EU includes like a future Ukraine with the United States, you know. But that's kind of different from the structure that NATO has become and the deal that Europe has made with America in that regard. I don't think that, like, we shouldn't make an alliance with Russia. We shouldn't make a defensive alliance with the United States. I don't think those are the same thing. It's just that the reliance on a foreign power is pretty dangerous if that power is as unstable as the United States is currently.
I think a lot of this, and a lot of Americans, and I know it might be weird to hear, but a lot of Americans are actually very supportive of the idea of Europeans either investing more into their own defense, because America generally has been one of the biggest backers financially of NATO for a very, very, very long time. And from a lot of American perspectives, it has been basically, and this is not necessarily a perspective I agree with, but kind of this idea of, like, we're sponsoring Europe's defense so they can have all the free healthcare and we're all dying in the streets. That's like the idea. That's, if you ask an American, some of the, I would think a good 40 to 50% of them would probably come to a conclusion somewhat similar to that, that we sponsor Europe's freedom in a way, right? Now, yes. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I do agree that the United States has been disproportionate when it comes to its funding of NATO, and it has been disproportionate when it comes to its funding of this, like, alliance structure. And it would be good to have other European powers invested more into the defense structure and to be taking more leadership roles into defense structure, so it's more of a united defense structure. I don't know if I would want the United States to be completely excluded from this, or if this could be a separate thing within the European Union, but I do think that Europe should generally be more invested so that when we see something like this happen with Ukraine, that it isn't, when you look at the aid, like 70% the United States, because let's say the United States is, you know, an isolationist mode at the moment, then another nation like Italy, Germany, or some other country could pick up the slack. Or if America's facing its own economic crises, like many nations in Europe are facing right now.
Two problems with that perspective of, like, the U.S. bankrolling European freedom, or sometimes...
I didn't agree with it. I said it's a narrative that comes up a lot. I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, I get that a lot too. Even to, like, the point that, you know, oh, Europe has all these, like, great, like, social welfare programs. You know, we could have that too if we weren't spending the money on protecting you from Russia and stuff like that. I know you don't agree with this. I just want to go into real quick of why that is nonsense. You know, first of all, the money that the U.S. spends in NATO countries don't strictly exist just for the protection of those countries. Again, this has a lot to do with power projection. You know, all the drones, or a lot of the drone strikes that happen in the Middle East that the United States is involved in have to go through Germany because of the curvature of the Earth, and they go through the relay station in Ramstein. You know, it's not like the United States is being strictly altruistic in their military spending in Europe. And the second problem I have with that, and United States presidents, going back to Eisenhower, have been complaining about, you know, Europe not spending enough on defense. There is no relationship at all between the United States military budget and European military budgets. You know, there's just none. You know, United States military budget goes up doesn't mean European military budgets go down. It just doesn't work that way. You know, it doesn't even seem to factor into the decision to raise the military budget or lower it. I think we can both agree that NATO has its problems. It's there right now. It would be great if we had something else. I'm not sure. What is your sense? Does NATO membership of Sweden and Finland make it more likely that the United States is really going to do the eternal pivot to Asia and focus less on Europe and rely on the Europeans to build up their own defense structures? Or do you think this is kind of like this reinforces the U.S. NATO presence in Europe?
I'm largely supportive of Taiwan. I don't want to, when people say pivot to Asia, it makes me sound like the United States is basically going to go to Asia. And if a war breaks out in Europe, it just is what it is, which I don't think is going to be the matter. Or it's going to be a situation. The United States is deployed in so many different areas in the world. And I think the United States might devote more time and resources to Asia going forward. But that doesn't come at, say, now America's just forgotten Europe existed. Or it is not still invested in European defense. It will most likely still be. It just might be paying more attention to Asia generally. And I do think, for the protection of Taiwan, I would like to see more defense structures in place if something went awry, or if the Chinese government made good on its threats, right? But when it comes to Europe, and definitely with the addition of Finland and Sweden, I do think that that's going to strengthen NATO. I do think that it gives Russia less wiggle room, and I do think that it could be the start of America a little bit, maybe leaning back a bit. I want America to still be actively involved. I want America to still work with its European allies, but I think that America also has other priorities, both at home and abroad, and I would like to see Europeans, and I mean, maybe this is a wild concept, Europeans being the leaders when it comes to European security.
I agree. I would love to see that. I don't know if it's going to happen, but you know.
I will say this, I still think you guys will almost always need America's backing in some way. It might be less, but I do think in some way you're going to still need America's backing in some way,
financially
or militarily.
The idea that, you know, let's say Germany or even France should like exit the NATO structures, that's a total fringe position in any of those countries, you know? That's like we might philosophize about, you know, what would be nice and what would we like to see happen, but in terms of public opinion, and even the governments, you know, where the German government, the French government, has a ton of Atlanticists sitting in there who have no desire at all to.
Can I tell you? This. Here's an interesting story. When I was in Poland, and this comes back to this idea of like European weakness on Ukraine, I interviewed the former Undersecretary of State of the Polish government. You know, he's not the Secretary of State. He's like the guy right under him, right? He was active in the Solidarity movement in Poland during the Soviet regime. He was arrested for his protesting with the Solidarity movement. He's been active in Polish politics for a long time. Right now, he's involved in Lublin city politics or regional politics, right? Which is...
Is he in PIS?
I wish I knew. Okay. I do not remember. But I wanted to tell you the story about this. I was interviewing him about Ukrainian relations, what does Poland think of Ukraine, yada, 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 what has Lublin done to help refugees? And eventually I got over to a question about Hungary. And the question was along the lines of, do you think Poland bears any responsibility for the protection of Viktor Orban and his government from the rest of the European Union when it comes to its authoritarian nature or anything like that? Do you think Poland bears any responsibility for kind of like backing it up? Because the idea has always been like Hungary and Poland are kind of like brothers and they've kind of backed each other up when it comes to like, you know, kind of like strategic hedging against the European like monitors who are like, that's kind of human rights abusey. I don't like that, buddy. And then they would both say buzz off together. So they have some ally speaking with them. And the whole interview, this guy had spoken like perfect English. He had been able to answer every question with poise and precision and with a complete dominance of the English language that might almost top mine. But then when I asked him about Viktor Orban, when I asked him about Hungary, all of a sudden, I don't have data for that. Mm-hmm. That was his answer. He was afraid to answer the question about Viktor Orban and Hungary. It's very clear to me that he was afraid to answer that question. And I feel like a lot of people who either backed up Viktor Orban and Hungarian government, which has been very confrontational with Ukraine, a lot of the far right in, say, countries like Poland, which or the right wing in Poland, which is a lot more anti-Russia than, say, the right wing in Italy, have kind of had to come, their eggs have come to roost when it comes to who they have been in bed with for a lot of this time and who they're willing to put up with, including Vladimir Putin. And so that interaction was very interesting to me because I think it showed that even if Ukraine or like we get through this crisis, we get through this geopolitical conflict, I think a lot of the people who, you know, laid the foundation for European like, what's the word? Will, fortitude, strength, cohesion on this issue, being so shaky. I don't think any of them are going to learn their lesson. I think right when this crisis ends, if it ever does in the near future, we're going to go straight to the same old patterns. I'm very afraid of that. That they're not going to work to build the structures to make it so next time it wouldn't be this difficult on the economy, or to work to build the structures to make it so Italy, Germany, Hungary, and other nations, which might have not been as supportive as we wish they would have been, would be more supportive in the future. I don't think the groundwork is going to be done. That's something that scares me. Not necessarily this crisis, which still does, but the next one that could come in the future.
Yeah, maybe the issue there is just a degree of threat perception, you know, that Poland knows that what is ultimately guaranteeing its safety is not Italy, it's not Germany, it's not France, it's the United States. And if there was a defense structure, going back to what we just talked before, where Poland knew that for its safety, it has to rely on all other European countries, that might be much better for European integration. But the Polish government is kind of in a weird spot, because their polling suggests they might actually get rinsed in the next election. And with Orban and Hungary and Poland kind of like being best buddies in the EU, I haven't looked into this too deeply, so I might be wrong. But that solidarity that you saw post 2015 seemed to be largely based on none of us want any brown people in our countries. You know, it really is like that. That was what ultimately got them. Not just those two, but the Visegrad Four also. The Visegrad Four in total.
I spoke to some of the leadership at Homo Faber, which is like a Polish like human rights organization, which was helping with refugees and like stopping human trafficking of like Ukrainian refugees coming in. And I was asking them about the difference on how a lot of the Afghan and Syrian and Kurdish refugees were treated, just like a few months prior, were being treated differently than compared to the Ukrainian refugees. And I hadn't even finished the question. I was like, so what do you think caused this problem? And she just looked me straight in the face. She said, racism. They're racist. That's why. They're racist. I was like, well, do you think? No, that's it. They're racist. And then the whole 20 minutes of dialogue I thought that question was going to lead into was just over in an instant, because she was just unbelievably blunt with me, which I appreciated.
Yeah, that's just true. I think we're running a bit low on time, and there's one topic I definitely want to get to, or two questions I have left for you. One is, coming from recent news, one thing, there has been a CBS report that they made a documentary, I think, about weapons to Ukraine, and that documentary alleged that like 30% of weapons doesn't really reach the Ukrainian, you know, stock. But before you answer to that, you know, that I know that number has been revised, and they said, I think in August or something, the U.S. put a guy in place to make sure, you know, everything gets to the front and it's a lot better now. And that was a response to a ton of backlash they got on social media. The second thing, and this is more recent, is the report of Amnesty International, who criticized some Ukrainian forces for allegedly putting civilians in harm's way. And the reaction to that in the mainstream press and on social media has been like totally vicious. You know, I feel like it's even more hostile reaction than when they released their report, which was an actual report, not just like some accounts on apartheid in Israel. You know, and Amnesty International has responded to that pressure by saying, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. Basically, you know, they stand by their report, but they are sorry for like the distress it has caused. And people are going as far to say
that,
as that.
I love
like,
that answer. I love that
yeah,
answer.
Yeah, what else are you going to say, you know? People are going as far as to say that like Amnesty International is now, you know, kind of responsible for Russia being able to attack hospitals and schools or civilian infrastructure, because they can always point to the Amnesty International report saying, you know, it's actually the Ukrainians who are putting civilians in harm's way. What do you think about that report? And do you think the reaction to the report is warranted?
So first I wanted to comment on the PBS. I think it was PBS, right?
CBS.
CBS report. So it was taken down. I was actually going to watch it, and they took it down before I could even watch the whole report, which is never a good sign. They then like added like some things like, ooh, it turns out we might have been wrong on this. We might have been wrong on that. Some of these numbers are a little
different
now.
They said it's outdated, I think.
It's outdated.
The number is outdated, yeah.
But also the clip that they got that 30% number from was from the testimony of one person, kind of like, and the person that is a respectable person too, so I do respect their account, saying like, It's around 30% while in a car interview. It wasn't like some leaked document where they found like 30% actually reaches it or something. It was there was a car interview is where they got.
Yeah, it was not the Afghanistan papers or something like that.
And on top of that, the 30% was specifically about, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it humanitarian aid? Which it wasn't about 30% of military aid reached the front line. It was like 30% of humanitarian. So there was the branding of the piece was kind of disingenuous and the numbers were out of date. And so for these two reasons was why it was taken down. I don't necessarily think it was malicious. I think the closest thing to it being malicious was the way they were advertising it.
It was a provocative headline. Yeah,
it was a provocative headline. It was clickbaity. It was clickbaity in a way. But when it comes to the Amnesty International report, so the first thing I want to say, and I need to say this before anything else, is I do not believe Amnesty International is backed by the Russians. That's ridiculous. I see a lot of people coming out saying that. No, they're not. They've been publishing reports on Russian war crimes for a very long time. When you see the Russian state media outlets talking about this report, they talk about it like these scumbag cockroaches at Amnesty International, because these reporters have had to read the other things that they have published. And I do think it was good. And I want to start with these compliments. I do want to think it was good that they made sure that in this report, they included, like, by the way, the Russians have committed this, this, and this crime as well. So it's more difficult for Russian propagandists to use it. But of course, they've just excluded that information and have kind of like still held it up as like a report for like the Times. My main issue with the report is that a lot of it, when it came to like... It was a lack of specifics, which is always aggravating when you just see a line where it gives you like one piece of detail and you want to know all the details because the context can change so much. For example, it talked about a lot of instances where hospitals were being or like schools were being used by Ukrainian forces. And in the report, it seems that these hospitals and schools were not being actively staffed, but they were abandoned due to people fleeing for the war. And so in this report, it doesn't really talk about like, okay, how distant was this from civilian forces or like civilian people? Or, okay, do you specify if this hospital had staff in it and it was an active operating hospital or if it was a hospital that was completely abandoned and was being used to defend a city? It doesn't get into those specifics, which was very aggravating to me because I think that context is really important when that context determines whether Ukraine is violating the agreement they signed to only use hospitals and schools they signed a certain agreement a few years ago where makes it so they only use hospitals and schools during a war if they absolutely strategically is necessary, which in most contexts, that would not be the case. But when you're being invaded by a foreign power, there obviously are going to be contexts where you're using a school or a hospital that is not staffed for defensive purposes is absolutely morally permissible. In fact, the SDF in Rojava during the Battle of Kobane used a school as their HQ, which then led to the first major defeat for ISIS, which then led eventually to the downfall of ISIS. So this isn't like the first conflict where which these buildings have been used. I think that lack of specifics and that lack of context is what hurts the report so much in my eyes. It's not that I don't think there's anything redeemable in the report. It's that I just wanted to be a lot more specific and give more like photographs and evidence and like being more descriptive. I think it could have used more time in the cooker. I also think that some of the things it complained about when it said we were in civilian territory and we could hear artillery in the distance. That's not a war crime. That's not against the laws of war. There has been no context in any war in human history where being able to hear your side firing at the enemy is enough for you to say that this is endangering civilians. If you are in an area where war is going on, that is just a possibility at all times. And that was one part of the report that really angered me too, because it felt like almost like it was concern trolling. And I felt like they were going to lengths that was a little even outside of like what I would entertain usually. So that was my main problems with the report. It's not that I don't wish a report happened. It's A, I wish that they were more specific. B, I think some of it when it came to hearing artillery in the distance, like that's not a war crime. I don't even know why you're bringing that up. I do think that they should have maybe been more communicative or worked more with the local Ukrainian office, which has been very, very obviously upset about this. And I do think they should have given the Ukrainian government more time to respond. I think this report could have been much better if they just gave it more time in the cooker, honestly. And I think it could have been useful.
I hesitate to even call it like a report, because if you compare it to the piece they did, the report they published on apartheid in Israel and the occupied territories, that's far over 100 pages. And yep. This is just basically like a website release.
It's like 2 pages. And it's, and it's no direct evidence, no photos, no links to more sources, nothing.
Exactly. And this is also why I happen to think that the reaction to this, not by Ukrainians, but mostly by Western liberals of Amnesty International having blood on their hands, I think is very overblown. I don't think this report, let's say everything in it is like 100% true. I don't even think that's a big deal, really. I don't know why people have this visceral reaction towards Amnesty saying there are instances where some Ukrainian units have not acted within international law 100% of the time. And there can be a legit reason for that. You know, there can be a strategic calculation where you say, basically what the report says, I think for the most part, is that, you know, I appreciate you going into details on the school and hospital stuff, but also, you know, behind the front line, the Ukrainians set up like an artillery position surrounded by civilian infrastructure when they could have set it up in a field or on a military base. Yeah. So, and because that is like inviting strikes from Russia onto that civilian infrastructure. Now, whether that is true or not, you know, there can be a calculation by the Ukrainian forces of why that actually makes sense. We don't know. Or maybe that field
there's a million reasons. Like
there's a million reasons we don't know.
The infrastructure provides, and you need to have troops in a city to hold the city. You can't just be in the surrounding forest. The Russians will just move in and they'll take the city.
Yeah, that's one thing. But there can be a million reasons. Doesn't mean it's not in accordance with international law. But I feel like the criticism of that report is like so disproportionate to what it actually is, you know, saying what does Amnesty International should like the Russians should just like given up Stalingrad because that was like a civilian city. You know, that's not what the report says at all. You know, it's mainly talking about things behind the front line where they don't know the calculation that the Ukrainians made, where they say, hey, maybe you should have put that like Himar or whatever. Maybe you should have put it on a field. But again, like it's just a report that says our Amnesty dudes, who have no idea what the Ukrainian military is, why it's operating in this way, there are instances where we have supposedly seen this. I don't know why people are so freaking angry at this. It really, and I'm curious what you think, but it strikes to me really as like, you know, someone who's like a really huge fan of like Taylor Swift, and then a story comes out of how she uses her private jet too much. And then they're like, well, actually, you know, what else is she supposed to do? And actually, that was like totally justified. You can just, you know, accept that happened. And it doesn't make you, it doesn't mean you have to like support Russia now. I think the war is good. You can just accept that as what it is. Because, you know, what difference is it going to make? The Russia doesn't need an excuse to target schools and hospitals. I get that this is like a propaganda victory for them because they're going to exploit it. But, you know, that doesn't mean you can't publish something like that, in my opinion.
Well, it's not that I think it should be illegal for them to publish it. I just think that they were shot. If you're going to publish a report where you're going to be critical of the nation who is the victim of the invasion, who's very obviously the victim of the majority of war crimes here, and you're going to be publishing a report where you're not like, well, they directly violated. There's not like an accusation here, like this needs to be taken to court or something.
No, it's just like eyewitness stuff, talking to witnesses and stuff like that. Yeah.
Like if you're going to publish a report like this, I think you need to do the proper legwork. Because if you don't, then you're going to be opening yourself up to this criticism. I don't think that they're... I think one example of this that really angered me in the report, and I'm going to say that before I give my final take on your question, was they had not appeared, or like they basically said multiple times they didn't know if Ukrainian military had warned locals in the area that they were there, which is a really weird thing to put in a report, because that would be the key factor, wouldn't it? If you go to people and you say, and this is what you're supposed to do under international law, like, hey, the military, we're here, like, just letting you know that we're here and we might be targeted. We're not like using your home or anything, but we're down the street. If they don't even know in the report if they did that or not, which would be the key factor, why include it in the report? You should be basing it on more credible knowledge that you have that's not working on. Well, they might have did something bad here, or they might have done something good. We don't know. We just didn't have the access to that information. And if you have those loose ends, you should at least wait for the Ukrainian government to respond when you send them this document, because they sent it to them and they give them 6 days to respond to this document, which I do think they could have waited for more time. And that 6 days that they gave to respond to that document only happened once the Ukrainian, local Ukrainian Amnesty International office requested it, which is pretty aggravating that they're going to have a bunch of loose ends in an article that they publish where they even admit they don't have all the information about, and they weren't even going to ask. They weren't even going to request a response, which I do think is pretty aggravating. But all of that aside, I do think the reaction to this has been overblown. I think a lot of people are trying to pretend that Amnesty International did this in a malicious manner. I think that's ridiculous. A lot of people are trying to pretend that they're being friendly for the Russian government. They have published a million reports on Russian war crimes and Russian atrocities that they've committed, much, 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 much more than they've ever published about Ukraine.
And they found this out while they were investigating Russian war crimes in Kharkiv. That was when they first stumbled upon occurrences like this, it says in the report.
Mm-hmm. And in this report, they even list out Russian war crimes that have been committed specifically so they could maybe hopefully counteract its propaganda purposes for the Russian government. Because if you're a pro-Russia and you're toying this report around, you're literally saying, hey, you look at this report where it says that our military committed a bunch of war crimes, shows how much you suck. Like it's not, but again, they can just ignore it. And I guess that's what's most aggravating to me, as I think this just could have been done better. But that doesn't mean that it was malicious or Amnesty International should be kicked out of Ukraine or that they don't care about Ukraine. I just think that more work should have been put into this and a lot of this could have been avoided. I think they were going to get some backlash no matter what because, you know, obviously a lot of Ukrainians are very defensive of their nation right now. But I think also a lot of this backlash could have been avoided with more proper work.
Yeah, I think it's in part with all politics, it's just that this issue gets plugged into people's self-perception. You know, when you're very vocal about supporting Ukraine and that it factors into you thinking of yourself as a good person that is morally upright. And then when an report comes out that says something like this, you feel uncomfortable and that pressure gets released somewhere. But as you said, if the report was actually more than, you know, I talked to this lady and she said that like Ukrainian soldiers stationed in the house next to her, and then her son died because like ammunition came flowing in. If it was actually more than that, then just we had these like five or six people who talked to a bunch of guys. If it was like a more detailed, thorough report similar to what they did in Israel and Palestine, or maybe like maybe a third of that, you know, the Ukrainian government could actually respond in a more effective manner and try to combat occurrences like this. While with the report right now, they can't really do anything because they don't even know like in what instances this happened and if it was like a strategic consideration or not.
They weren't even given the time to do anything. And the thing is, like, here's maybe an example I could give. And I think this is more drastic of an example. I interviewed a nun who was in Bucha during the Russian occupation. She's one of the nuns from that famous church where the mass grave was. And she ran up to us to just tell her our story. She saw our cameras. We hadn't requested an interview beforehand. She just ran up to us. We just published a video about it. And I would hope people go check it out because since it's a video of me just talking to locals, it hasn't gotten the same amount of love as a video of me interacting with soldiers has. But I think it's a good video. And in the interview with her, she talks about how she had neighbors who were shot simply for speaking Ukrainian. And that is a horrendous thing to witness. A horrendous thing to hear. I am not, off of her testimony, going to publish a 5-page report on how Russians executed people in Bucha for speaking Ukrainian. I will tell, hey, I got this testimony. I'll say that. I can bring that out. I can go maybe submit this to somebody to have it investigated if I wanted to. But I don't have enough there for a report. I don't have any photos. I don't got any video from that testimony alone. I could take the satellite images from Bucha, bring that in. I could go get some more testimony. I could take photos of the bullet holes that had entered the bodies of a lot of these victims as testified as the local police chief, meaning that they were executed. I could get DNA. There's a lot of things I would need to do properly before I release the report, because let's say that that's true, and I believe her, if you want my personal opinion about it. The last thing I want to do is release a report that's bad so people can just dismiss the accusation as, oh, that's that thing from that shoddy report that like doesn't show any evidence. Which now, if people bring this up, a lot of people are just going to say, the Ukrainian government doesn't need to do anything. Because all I remember is that shoddy Amnesty International report, which didn't even show any evidence, and is being used by the Russian propagandists. And so I just wish there was more legwork done.
My last question for you today, and maybe it's the experience that you just talked about, but since you have arrived in Ukraine so far, what moment or what site or what conversation so far do you think stuck with you the most?
I'll say two moments, because it depends, because like things can stick out to me for different reasons. I'll exclude the moment I just talked about, because that was a big moment too. But while I was in Bucha, I talked to a woman who invited us into her apartment, and we go into the apartment building, and every single apartment building is completely destroyed, burnt out, wreckage. It's again, in the recent video we uploaded, everything is destroyed except for hers. Her apartment is the only one left standing. She doesn't have electricity. And we interview her, and she talks about it being warm from inside her apartment because of the flames, the fire, and how scared she was and how much she wants Western support, and how there was nothing she could do as her building caught on fire 3 separate times. Could you imagine being sent photographs while you're not there? He's like, oh, your house just caught on fire one time. Oh, your house just caught on fire the next day again. And every single one of your neighbors loses everything. You're probably never going to see them again. Many of them are dead. And somehow you just struck the lottery there when it comes to your house. And saying you struck the lottery there is maybe not appropriate, because what, not a great prize, to be completely honest. But I could see like a combinations of happiness that she still had all of her belongings. Sadness because, of course, it's incredibly hot. She doesn't have, you know, electricity for air conditioning or anything. She doesn't have like a lot of the basic necessities she used to. And almost like a feeling of like survivor's guilt that I could read, which was very strange to have somebody almost like you could feel survivor's guilt off of them from something that, again, isn't their fault at all. That was something that stuck with me a lot, because I opened the door after that interview and I just looked to the right and all I can see is rubble. That like the only thing that separated all of her belongings from being destroyed was just like a few inches. It's really wild. And so that was something that stuck with me on an emotional level. When it comes to like personal experiences, I mean, the easy one for me to say would be my interaction with a Russian drone when I was in Zaporozhye. I always pronounce it wrong, but that's just how it is. I'm an American. We're allowed to. I went to the front line with Ukrainian troops. And while we were driving out over to a position on the front line, which was a mile from the Russians, we stop on the way there and we pull off to the side of the road. And the reason why is the position we were heading to was getting shelled. And while it was getting shelled, we had to wait. And so we're on the side of the road, we're waiting, and then out of nowhere, I hear like the sound. It's like a, like, you ever hear your phone vibrating? It's like a buzzing, but it's not like an animal buzzing, which you can tell when like an insect's buzzing. It's like a mechanical buzzing. And I hear it, and I turn to Patrick. I'm like, is that like an alarm, or do you hear that? And he's like, what? And I was like, oh, never mind. Because I was just like, whatever, right? Like 5 seconds after I say whatever, somebody says drone. What that sound was, it was a drone which had spotted me and the rest of the journalists who were there. And so we had to quickly run into the forest and hide there as we started to hear the artillery in the distance. We heard it sporadically, but it started to pick up a bit. Up to that point, it was sporadically, but it started to pick up a bit. Then we go and we jump back in the van after like 5 minutes, because it seems like, I don't know if they have a plan or if they didn't have a plan. They were just like, fuck it, let's wing it. We all get into the van and we drive down. We probably like 2 miles back the way we came, go back into the forest. And then the artillery starts to get closer. I don't know why we drove back into the forest. It might be they just wanted, I think it was they wanted to conceal the van more since it was camouflaged. But at that point, we finally wanted to actually get out of the situation. So we once again get into the van, but this time the van breaks down. And so there's a drone in the area spotting us. The artillery, we can hear it getting closer, and the van just broke down. And at that moment was probably like the moment I was most like, ah, fuck, this is a war, huh? And eventually the van turns on. It would break down again later that day when we were a mile from the Russians, which was fun, you know? Just an example of why they need military aid, because they're literally using soccer mom vans. It's not like an armored vehicle I was being transported. I was being transported in a soccer mom van painted green with a shot transmission, right? That's what I was being transported in. So that was probably personally a moment that was pretty crazy for me. If you wanted something outside of just like depressing personal stories. One story to lighten the mood slightly. Do you know who Desmond Doss is?
I don't believe so.
Desmond Doss was an American medic during the Second World War who refused to use a gun because it went against his religion. Oh, yeah.
I saw the Mel Gibson movie.
The movie Hacksaw Ridge is a story about how he saved a lot of people during a battle against the Japanese with no gun, as he was a moral objector. I met my own Desmond Doss while I was in the Donetsk Oblast on the route to Kramatorsk. I actually met a medic who refuses to use weapons due to religious obligations and instead has a bulletproof shield and bulletproof armor he'll put on so he can run and grab people and drag them away. He's 59 years old. He looked like a magician, man. He looked like it was crazy. We felt like a Ukrainian wizard, and he would just go on for like hours telling us stories. I got so much footage of him telling stories. I can't wait to publish it, where he'll like talk about like thermobaric weapons, and he didn't know how to explain it to us because we spoke English and our translator was out of the room. So he just picked up a lighter, and like turned it on, and just went like whoosh with his hands. Like such a character.
Our prayers go out to the Ukrainian medic wizard and
true.
Our resident CIA war dog, Dylan Burns. Thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to tell people where to find your stuff?
Awesome. I'd be happy to tell people where they can go and give me support. You can find me on YouTube. That's DYLANBURNS TV, Dylan Burns TV on YouTube. You can also find me with the same name on Twitch. I stream weekdays from 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to midnight Eastern Standard Time. I also have a Twitter, which is Dylan Burns 1776 for all you Yanks out there. That's DYLANBURNS 1776. And I've released two videos so far on the ground in Ukraine if you guys wanted to check it out. And I'm really trying to push my YouTube right now. So any support you could throw over to my YouTube, I would greatly appreciate. And thank you so much for listening to my friendly German friend here and continuing to watch his podcast. And you should totally go to his Patreon and support him.
Thank you, Dylan. And thank you to our listeners. Take care and stay safe.